Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
What have we found here? Is it really evidence of an ancient civilization? In North America? Is it possible that more than just a nomadic culture lived here 12,000 years ago?
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is a clip from a film by Northwest resident Jack Gunter called The Mount Vernon Culture.
To try to answer anything, we have to look at the Rocky Point artifacts a little closer. A clue is found in a story about a flood.
In the film, Gunter puts forward several anthropological theories based on ancient paintings, vases, and other artifacts that he unearthed in the Pacific Northwest, including this.
There was a growing body of evidence that suggests the story of Noah and his ark had its roots in the Pacific Northwest. Many attempts to locate the remains of this legendary vessel on the snowy sides of Turkey's Mount Ararat have met with failure. Perhaps they should look instead at Mount Baker.
That's right. Gunter suggests that the remnants of Noah's Ark might be buried in Whatcom County. The clincher is the rare footage included in the film showing female descendants of an ancient civilization still playing hockey, naked, on a remote mile-high glacier deep in the North Cascades. Gunter displayed his findings at an exhibit about 19 years ago in Seattle, but there's just one thing.
Are these actual documents of your discovery?
No, this is a completely staged place that I put together because I wanted to make a very simple concept. And of course, these aren't real. These aren't legitimate. This woman is not an archaeologist.
Yes, fake news. In fact, if you look closely at the so-called artifacts, you can see that among the images of boats and animals and ice caps, there are also images of Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich and the Clintons. Gunter made all of it. In addition to being an artist and a bit of a brat, Jack Gunter refers to himself as a pataphysician, which he defines as a writer of parody of modern science. When you revise history, it can go either way. You can nudge the story a little further from the truth, like Jack, or you can correct the mistakes and omissions in the historical record. We'll have a little bit of both today. Revising history is our theme, right here on Sound Effect. At most cemeteries, the graves tell a little story: the name of the person buried there, the day they were born, and the day they died. But at some cemeteries, the graves say nothing. That's the case at a historic cemetery outside of Western State Hospital. It's an inpatient psychiatric hospital in Lakewood, Washington. The people buried there died while getting treatment for mental illness. Their graves went unmarked so that their families could keep that fact secret. The cemetery closed down nearly 70 years ago, and in the time since, attitudes about mental health have changed a lot. Now, because of a small group of volunteers, this cemetery is changing too. Sound Effect's Posey Gruner has the story.
When we started out,
Laura Lemke unrolls a paper map under her kitchen table.
This is all we had.
It shows the location of thousands of graves.
And you'll notice that the markers are all just numbers.
The first burial in this cemetery was in 1876.
The lowest numbers we have are 17, 18, 19, 20.
Back then, it was the cemetery for the insane asylum of Washington Territory.
7, 28, 29,
the last 30, burial was in 1953, when the hospital was known simply as Western State Hospital.
2750.
More than 3,000 people are buried there. Above each grave is a small, flat stone carved with a number.
2755,
there has always been a record of who was buried under which number, but that record was sealed.
2760. So it doesn't mean much, doesn't these numbers, but then to put the real names in there meant so much.
Taking these numbers and turning them into names has been Lemke's passion for nearly 20 years. It all started around the year 2000. At that time, Lemke was working at Western State Hospital, and someone got in touch with her because they wanted to hold a memorial at the cemetery. The event was a success, but one thing bugged Lemke. The grave markers were all sunken into the ground, covered over by grass, barely even visible.
We thought maybe, you know, that the markers had disintegrated, but they were all under the ground.
Lemke wanted to do something about it. So she organized a group of people, and they brought the numbered stones back to level ground, where people could see them. That was the beginning. Today, 20 years later, Lemke is the chairwoman of a volunteer organization called the Grave Concerns Association. The association has just one purpose: to install headstones with names in this cemetery. It's a tangible way to do something symbolic, to lift the stigma from mental illness. Lemke is passionate about this because she knows what mental illness is like.
I had my life interrupted several times.
It started in college. She would have symptoms of mania and then experience a long depression. It would go away and then come back. But Lemke feels lucky. Luckier than most of the people buried here.
When I first had my symptoms, it was in the 70s. Medications and treatments were available. I didn't have to go to state hospital. I didn't have a fate like this. I was able to have a productive career.
Lemke ended up working in the field of mental health as an advocate for people with mental illnesses. She's retired now, but she still tends to the cemetery.
And where we're going to be going today, where our big markers are right here.
The big markers, as Lemke calls them, are places where hundreds of cans of cremated remains are buried in a single grave. The marker she points out, number 2695, is the final resting place for about 500 people. Today, they're going to place a headstone above can number 331. To get to the cemetery, Lemke drives a few minutes down the road from her house, turns left at Western State Hospital, and enters Fort Steilacoom Park. This land used to be the hospital's farm. Now there are soccer fields and a dog park, and a little cemetery surrounded by a fence. The weather is blustery and wet. A small crowd stands in the corner of the cemetery, squinting into the wind. One of them is dressed appropriately for the day, with duck boots, a cap, and some work gloves. This is Jim Elvis, and he's here to lay the headstone.
It's nice to be here trying to accomplish something positive.
Elvis is a genealogist, and he'd run into a problem when he was making a family tree for his cousin. He couldn't find her grandmother's grave.
This is the death certificate I got. But you can see they don't mention the place of burial. They just put cremation.
Elvis had wanted to give his cousin a picture of her grandmother's grave, and that's usually pretty easy. Just go to findagrave.com and type in her name. But in this case, Elvis had to look a little harder. Finally, he came across the Grave Concerns website.
It was number, grave number 2695 and can number 331. Yeah, her name.
So he'd found a name and a number, but no headstone to take a picture of.
I'm sure they didn't mean anything negative by handling it the way they did. I mean, back then it was a stigma and people were ashamed to be associated with them.
So, quick story here. The fact that Elvis found anything on that database at all, that's also due to grave concerns. The stigma that kept her name off the headstone also kept her name off publicly accessible records. And before they could do anything in this cemetery, first they had to change that. There were barriers to changing it. Concerns about medical privacy, like HIPAA laws. Concerns that families might not want it to be public knowledge that their ancestors were buried outside a mental hospital.
I can tell you there was someone known in our state history, prominent name, that had a family member at the hospital. And that was never discussed. Their family member was there at the hospital.
So there were hurdles. But one Grave Concerns volunteer, Sherry Storms, was determined to give these people more than just a number.
She kept saying, I want the names. I want to have the names. And I kept saying, it's a law. We can't give you the names.
Finally, they decided to see what it would take to change that. They weren't lawyers, but they figured it out. They rewrote the relevant bit of state code and lobbied to get the changes made into law. And then, in 2004, they passed Senate Bill 6678. It totally changed Lemke's idea about what's possible.
So a lot of times people say, you can't do that, it's against the law. I always say, well, we can change the law.
As for installing the headstones, they've gone slowly. they rely on private donations, a team of volunteers, and the occasional manual labor from a genealogist.
It's already got a little mark there.
Elvis digs a shallow hole out of the turf, the same size and shape as the marker. They're leaving the original grave number as is, but they're adding a headstone, one with her name and her lifespan.
Corners are the most important.
Yeah, I would think.
For Elvis, this is the last step in his research into his cousin's grandmother. He didn't know her at all before he started, but he feels like he's gotten to know her a little bit.
When I research a person, they sort of become alive. Once you know where they live, who they were married to, and their kids, you start to get sort of an impression of them.
He learned that she was born in 1897. She got married when she was 20 years old. She had five kids. In 1936, she was admitted to Western State Hospital. The doctors listed her diagnosis as dementia precox. That's an old diagnosis for what today is usually called schizophrenia. She died 3 years later.
I think that's deep enough.
Elvis wrestles the stone into the spot.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, yeah, so just a little bit of dirt in.
When it's in place, he reads the headstone aloud.
It says, Ruby Violet Knight, 1897 to 1939.
Ruby Violet Knight. Elvis lays a wreath on her grave.
It reflects on ourselves. I think people that tend to degrade people are degraded themselves. And maybe if we look upon people as somebody of worth instead of cans in the number, that somehow gives us a sense of worth, too.
Usually, at this point, someone from Grave Concerns would stand and read a poem. They often read The Dash by Linda Ellis. But not today. It's too wet and windy. So they move on to the next part of the ritual.
Hi.
How are you?
Yes, I'm
good today.
Over time, Lemke has learned how important it is to gather afterward.
We just put a marker in the cemetery.
Did you really?
It's like the wake after the funeral, partly for the dead, but mostly for the living. By reaffirming the value of the people buried here, they reaffirm the value of all life.
I mean, our whole thing is about restoring dignity, and it's an important thing to do.
The work is far from complete. There are more than 1,000 graves to go. But for today, at least, this small group of people has helped restore dignity to one person, Ruby Violet Knight, 1897 to 1939.
That story from Sound Effects' Posey Gruner. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is revising history. They say that history is written by the victors, and those victors sometimes omit certain inconvenient facts. But we're about to meet a Seattle woman determined to correct the record. First, we need a quick refresher on the historical chapter in question. It's the Civil War in El Salvador. Back in the early 80s, poor Salvadorans were pushing for their government to redistribute wealth. To the cold warriors in the U.S., that sounded like a big old communist power grab. For President Ronald Reagan, this was an alarming development right in his backyard.
Central America's problems do directly affect the security and the well-being of our own people. And Central America is much closer to the United States than many of the world trouble spots that concern us. So, we work to restore our own economy. We cannot afford to lose sight of our neighbors to the south. El Salvador is nearer to Texas than Texas is to Massachusetts.
A civil war broke out in El Salvador, pitting the so-called leftist guerrillas against the government and military. The U.S. sided with the Salvadoran government. So that's the backdrop for the work of Professor Angelina Godoy, who runs the University of Washington's Center for Human Rights. She says one reason the war dragged on for more than a decade was that the U.S. helped bankroll the Salvadoran government's war.
And so this overblown fear of communism led the Salvadoran government, heavily supported by the U.S., to engage in a series of scorched earth campaigns against, oftentimes against people that had nothing to do with armed revolution, followed up by on-the-ground movement of troops that involved the destruction of entire villages, literally wiping out entire communities, burning their crops, destroying their homes, killing their livestock, and making sure they could never return to live there again.
When the war finally ended, the United Nations estimated that 75,000 civilians had died. Over the past 10 years, Angelina Godoy and a group of dedicated students have been asking the U.S. government for hundreds of documents. They've already combed through thousands of pages, trying to piece together the hidden history of the war. Godoy joined us to explain why she thinks it's so important to find the truth about a war that many Americans have forgotten or never knew existed in the first place.
To this day, not one person has been held accountable in a court of law for ordering these horrendous crimes against humanity, despite the fact that everyone knows they happened, the mass graves are there, bodies have been recovered, et cetera. So there's abundant evidence, and yet there has been no accountability. But I would say another piece that is equally important is historical memory of what happened, is gathering the story from survivors and evidence that fleshes out that story so that it can be preserved for future generations, and so that people can understand what happened and hopefully work to prevent its repetition.
And so what was like the magnitude of the U.S. involvement in this? How much help did the U.S. give to the Salvadoran government?
Well, one of the figures that's often bandied about is that the average of U.S. Overt assistance to El Salvador over the course of the conflict was $1 million a day.
$1 million a day. And
yes.
That's over years?
Yes.
How many years?
12. And so what that meant on the day-to-day level is that news was coming back and forth, right, across the cables about what was happening each day, you know, things that were being reported both to military sources, to diplomatic sources, intelligence information, et cetera, was coming continually across the transom. And that information is now archived. But access to those archives is extraordinarily difficult. And so that's where we've built our work over these years.
Can you think of an example of a document or a trove of documents that there was a lot of push and pull over and that you eventually did get and that then shed light on something that you were really interested in finding out about?
I guess one of them would be this document that we obtained relatively recently from the CIA, which related to the massacre of Hermosote, which is still considered to this day the worst massacre of its sort in the modern history of the Americas. We're talking since the Spanish and Portuguese conquest. So over 1,000 people are believed to have been killed in this single, it's actually a set of massacres that transpired over a few days, and more than half of those were children. So really one of those horrific crimes that strains the imagination to understand how we as human beings are even capable of perpetrating that kind of violence against one another.
And again, this was the Salvadoran military or?
Correct.
People working on their behalf.
It was the Salvadoran military, multiple different units of the Salvadoran military that perpetrated this massacre in December 1981. So for all of those reasons, when I opened the envelope and saw that this was a document that related directly to Hermosote, and not only that it was a document relating directly to Hermosote, but that it described troops firing blindly, that struck me as amazing. And, you know, one of those moments where you sort of your hands almost shake as you're holding the paper. Part of the reason why is that the United States government carried out a cover-up of the massacre, denied that it had happened, claimed it was a fabrication. So while discovering that the United States government knew and lied was not a surprise, this was another piece of evidence that hadn't before been seen. And I think the work that I do and that my students and I do exposes the fact that much as we might like to think these were secrets, we're discovering the truth to. It's actually always been known, right? These are things that have always been known. And yet the United States has never reckoned with its role in that conflict. The Salvadoran government has not reckoned with its responsibility for the killing of its own citizens. And I think that just makes it too easy for us to just turn the page and, you know, order drone strikes in another place against people we believe to be terrorists without ever really scratching the surface to see, well, what's the evidence here? What is it? And if they are terrorists or if they are committing crimes, shouldn't a court hold them accountable? Is the real answer here to commit these kinds of war crimes?
What's been the reaction of the people that you work with in El Salvador, in this case anyway, to the things that you've discovered?
Many times. In fact, typically the response of people is that this information, even if it's partial, even if it doesn't answer everything, even if it doesn't ever, will never bring back lost loved ones, just the fact that they have more information for people who have been systematically silenced for decades, who have been denied any access or even denied the opportunity to demand that their case be heard in a court of law. I think it's also useful, especially for young people who have grown up without a parent or without a loved one, who are always trying to piece together even tiny bits of information, right, about what was my dad like? What did people who knew him remember him for? Like, so sometimes the documents can reveal little things like the color of the vehicle in which somebody was last seen. Those may not be the things that break open a criminal case, but they're part of a person's process of memorializing a loved one.
What light do you think that the emerging record that you're helping to uncover sheds on some of the issues that we're contending with today? So, you know, geopolitical issues and issues of U.S. involvement in Central America and immigration and all these things that are so tied together.
I think the legacies of what the United States supported in Central America could not be more apparent than the headlines we're seeing now of Central Americans fleeing untenable living situations in their countries. And the United States supported those wars, trained people to carry out those wars, provided the bullets that were put in the guns. And so these legal systems that have been built to look the other way when powerful people commit abuses, that those same institutions are now inept or unwilling to rise to the challenge of providing security for their population, right? And so people can only endure so much suffering and violence for so long before they flee to save their lives. And that's what we're seeing now.
You talked earlier on about just being motivated to understand the why and the real roots of this type of violence and these atrocities. What do you think you've learned that speaks to that?
A lot of it's about power and unquestioned power, right? So the power that those military commanders had when they entered into the village of El Mozote and decided to eliminate all of those people, they didn't think anybody would ever question them for that. One of the sad things I've learned is that these abuses are not rare. They happen all the time. And I think the best way to prevent them is by trying to close those gaps of power. And I think that's partly a task for all of us as citizens or as people engaged in democratic societies to demand to know what's being done in our name.
Yeah. Well, Professor Angelina Godoy is Director of the Center for Human Rights at the University of Washington. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today, our theme is revising history. This is the story about a woman who found herself in the middle of history being made and decided to, you know, mess with it. It takes place in the early 90s when Seattle was having a cultural moment. The grunge scene was exploding, and suddenly all these people who didn't know Seattle from Shelbyville wanted in on the action. That included the paper of record, the New York Times. But their reporter soon found himself outfoxed by a clever and highly caffeinated young woman named Megan Jasper. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing takes it from here.
Sub Pop Records in Seattle was in the thick of everything in the early 1990s. The small label was the launching pad for Nirvana, Soundgarden, and Mudhoney. Megan Jasper was in her early 20s when her love of music led her from Massachusetts to the West Coast. She got a job working the front desk at Sub Pop.
I would describe the office as this incredibly creative, weird space where anyone who may have been a misfit in any way felt probably welcomed.
Even though the music scene was boiling over, Sub Pop's finances back then were not. Megan and a bunch of other people got laid off. One day, her old boss at Sub Pop gave her a call. They were still on good terms. He told her that the New York Times had called him and that they wanted to do a story about the culture of grunge. Megan's old boss punted the call to her.
He knew that I love a prank and knew that maybe I could use a break in the day.
A day that was already really buzzing.
I maybe was on my third or fourth French press. I was just in a mode that probably is similar to this sound. And I went for it.
The reporter from the New York Times wanted Megan to tell him how people in the grunge scene talked. What was their secret language?
And I just thought, really? Okay, like, sure, but there really wasn't a secret language or, you know, it seemed like a fairly bizarre request to me. So I just thought, sure, you want a lexicon? I will totally give you a lexicon. And I remember at that moment jotting things down. And what I was jotting down were words that rhymed. I was jotting down funny expressions that came from all different places. So I sort of just said, well, why don't you give me a word and I'll give you the grunge translation.
First, they covered clothes.
I'll try to make something sound a little believable. So fuzz, because people were wearing kind of fuzzy looking sweaters. Big boots, I called kickers. I thought that's kind of believable. And then I just thought this is where I can stretch my answers.
Lame stain.
Loser.
The list wasn't very long.
Big bag of bloatation.
Drunk.
But it was really specific.
Tom Tom Club.
Uncool outsiders.
Whack slacks.
Old ripped jeans.
Cobb Knobbler.
Loser.
And all I could hear was this. I could hear the writer typing on their keyboard. The answers got weirder. Bound and Hagged. Bound and Hagged is staying home on a Friday or Saturday night. Who would ever have a word for that anyways? Seriously? And Swinging on the Flippity Flop was inspired by the son of a diner owner in Northampton, Massachusetts. He used to wear a shirt that said, "See you on the Flippity Flop," and it always cracked me up when I would see him walking down Main Street. So I just thought Swinging on the Flippity Flop could be hanging out. It was never questioned. We never got to a point where anybody said, oh, come on, like, this is crazy or this isn't true. So it became our little pretend language.
A few weeks passed. Megan forgot about the call. Then, early one morning, her phone rang. It was her mom.
And my mom from Worcester, Massachusetts, who read the New York Times every day, said, Jesus Christ, have you looked at the paper today? So I said, no, I didn't. What's happening? And she said, go to the store and get a paper and call me back. So I went down to the store. I got the New York Times. I brought it back and all I could think was, oh, This got printed in the New York Times.
Megan felt bad for lying, and she was worried what her friends in Seattle would think. Would they be offended? Would they be confused? No. Everyone here in the Northwest, they got it. They got the joke.
I remember being at a show at the Crocodile Cafe, and I remember people cutting out the lexicon and putting a safety pin through it and wearing it on their shirts. It gave people a good laugh. And I think people were grateful for that because there were wonderful moments. There were also many eye roll moments back then because everything was changing so fast. And because You couldn't do anything without people studying it.
A few more months ticked by, and a reporter for The Baffler, a left-wing magazine, got in touch with Megan. The reporter wanted to confirm that the lexicon of grunge was indeed a hoax.
And he called me after that, and he said, I just have to tell you the New York Times is irate. They're feeling embarrassed and humiliated, but all of, like, so many other writers are, like, think this is the greatest thing in the world, and who could pull a prank on the New York Times? And I just thought, well, apparently anybody can. I don't think I'm that special.
An editor from the New York Times Styles section called. She was screaming at Megan over the phone. But the editor was also trying to play it cool, telling Megan that the paper knew the whole time that this strange vocabulary list was really just all tongue-in-cheek. Some of the words started to take on a life of their own. One of them, lamestain, showed up printed on t-shirts. Megan eventually went back to work at Sub Pop. Today, she's the CEO. And she fully supports pranks in the office. Back to that angry phone call from the New York Times Styles editor. After all of the yelling was done, but before the line went dead between the East and West Coast, the editor asked Megan one last question. Do you know where I can get one of those lamestain t-shirts?
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and our theme today is revising history. Sometimes tourist attractions package up history for us, all tied up in a neat bow. And we want to believe what our tour guide tells us. I mean, they're the experts, right? But like any good story, especially one that's existed for decades, there's always the chance that over time, the facts have been polished a little bit. Well, when writer Hannah Brooks Olson moved to Seattle 10 years ago, she was looking for a way to really learn about the old days of Seattle, outside of the books and grainy photos. But at the tourist attraction she turned to, Hannah found what she learned might not be the real deal. And then she wondered, does it actually matter? She shares this essay.
When I asked around about how I could get my hit of history, I heard the same advice over and over. The underground tour. Really? A tourist attraction? That's the answer? For a lot of people, it is. Creepier than a museum and more immersive, quite literally, than a trip to the library, the underground tour remains one of Seattle's most beloved portals into those pre-Gold Rush days. That's the goal of it, anyway. Created by former Seattle Times writer and self-made historian Bill Spiedel, the Underground Tour purports to remind us of who we were before Microsoft, Starbucks, Ichiro, and Death Cab for Cutie, according to the website. In addition to being a writer and gentleman historian, Spiedel and his wife, Shirley, were active in the historic preservation community. They created the tour as a way to make our collective history more visible and tangible, and in doing so, Spiedel hoped, encourage an interest in saving old buildings and locations.
We kept wandering around these old abandoned sidewalks, and the public curiosity was out of this world. That's when we started the underground tours.
That's Bill Spiedel in an interview from 1981, 7 years before his death. As the Spiedels beat their fists, the story goes, against City Hall, fighting what the underground tour calls, quote, government-sanctioned devastation, the idea that you could bulldoze blight, start ever so fresh, and live happily, sanitarily ever after, unquote, they also drummed up public support. As a result, Pioneer Square was deemed a historic landmark neighborhood, spared from the demolition team. Spokespeople for the Underground Tour didn't want to give an interview, so I decided to take the tour to see whether or not it would satisfy my insatiable need to know more about this town.
I'm going to meet the experts on at old Seattle history for the next 15 minutes, and I'm delighted to have you all here.
The basic information that's baked into the tour, a script which Speidel wrote himself and ultimately turned into a series of books, all of which are for sale, by the way, at the gift shop at the end of the tour, trickles upwards from the sunken basements of Pioneer Square to the cultural consciousness of those who live and work here. Jillian Thomas is a Redmond native. In the aforementioned gift shop, she tells me that she's taken the tour nearly a dozen times because, as a local, it makes her proud.
Every time you go in, you get a different story. You see something different. Somebody always has like a story from their own time period, their own city. And he really did protect the culture.
Indeed, we as Seattleites love the miscreants in our stories. And we largely have Speidel to thank for knowing their names. Here's Speidel again from 1981.
San Francisco wrote its rascals into its history while Seattle was writing its rascals out of its history. And I'm writing the rascals back in, and they're interesting guys, you know.
Speidel set out to ensure that those rascals were never forgotten, and in fact, he wanted to put them front and center. He loved a dirty joke, a wild turn, and the occasional dash of casual sexism. And sometimes, that means the hard facts came second. Right above where Jillian and I talked hangs a particularly large example. It's a portrait of a handsome woman sitting stylishly among several other prim women. The woman is, purportedly, Madame Lou Graham. And it seems to be the only photo anyone knows of the famed brothel owner and silent financial backer of young Seattle. But for some reason, the picture has always rubbed me wrong. So I asked historian Paul Dorpat about it. Dorpat, who has written a weekly column for the Seattle Times for longer than I've been alive, is credited as the owner of the photo. And over chowder at Ivar's, he gave me the full story. Here's what happened as he tells it. Years ago, a friend of Dorpat's found a box of glass negatives at a used bookstore. And among them was this photo. Interested in who might be pictured, he asked someone who was known for two key characteristics, according to Dorpat: his willingness to give interviews and his considerable age. Joshua Green, born in 1868, lived to be 105 years old and remained gregarious until the end. He and his family were notable early Seattleites. According to Dorpat, Green was at Graham's brothel once when the police raided the joint, and Green escaped by shimmying down a pipe.
And Joshua said, "Oh, that's Graham." So that's a lot of evidence. A guy who was gregarious. He knew lots of people. He came from a powerful family that was always involved in things, and he identified her.
So Dorpat published a story featuring the image, and the rest was history. Kind of. Years later, though, Dorpat would note a discrepancy. Specifically, looking through the rest of the slides, he found images of buildings that weren't built until well after Graham died in 1903. He corrected the record slightly. A sidebar in Seattle, 1900 to 1920, which he co-authored with Richard C. Berner, states, "The original negative for this Seattle scene is part of a collection of glass plates, all of Seattle subjects, that date from around 1910.
So I concluded it wasn't her, and although it didn't stop me from writing a story.
But the damage, if you can call it damage, is done, and the photo still makes the rounds. It's on HistoryLink, and it's used in any number of blog posts and articles. So it's gospel, because that's how we share our history. We pass it around just like our ancestors did, telling stories and maybe embellishing here and there, but there's usually a grain of truth in there, somewhere. That's the case with another famous Graham rumor, which can be sourced to the writing of Bill Speidel. The story about how, when she died, she bequeathed her considerable estate to the Seattle Public Schools. That isn't true, but not for lack of trying. While King County wanted Graham's money, she didn't bequeath it to them. Quite the opposite, she had little in the way of last wishes, and her death led to a 3-year-long land grab between her attorney, local government officials, and her long-lost relatives back in Germany. The money ended up going to her family, not the schools. But if you ask a Seattleite, they'll most likely tell you Speidel's version, whether they know it or not. Graham's building, located at the corner of Washington and 3rd, is a historic landmark. To commemorate her legacy, there's a plaque which reads, "On her death in 1903, her estate was given to the public schools of King County." Speidel's book was used as a source for the inscription. When we talked, Dorpat told me that it doesn't matter. The story is the story, whether it's exactly true or not. It's probably true that I wouldn't even know about Madame Lou Graham were it not for Speidel. But I don't know that I love that answer. Because to me, the reason that our history is skewed is that it hasn't been told by enough people. The reason that the facts are wrong is because the facts have been funneled through the individual lenses consisting of memories and assumptions. This isn't out of spite. In telling stories about Seattle, and yes, sometimes polishing them up for public consumption, Speidel froze the town in time. He made space for those of us who can't get enough of how it once was. Now, maybe it's up to the rest of us to peel back that history a little bit and see what else there is to find, and maybe even set it a little more straight. I think that correcting the plaque on Madame Lou Graham's building is a good place to start. But a generation later, as the city looks around to decide what can or should be saved, Speidel's legacy is not that he bent the truth, but rather that he salvaged the places where the truth took place.
Hannah Brooks Olson is a writer in Seattle. She's currently working on a book about Madame Lou Graham. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and the theme for our show today is revising history. Now we meet two people motivated to rewrite a story that casts someone they admire as the villain. When you think of Richard Nixon, the first thing to pop into your head is probably Watergate. Quick recap, Nixon was found to have abused his power to investigate his political enemies. 69 people were indicted, 48 were found guilty, and Nixon ended up resigning from office on August 9th, 1974.
I leave with no bitterness toward those who have opposed me. Because all of us in the final analysis have been concerned with the good of the country, however our judgments might differ.
Now, one person who never stopped defending Richard Nixon was his brother, Ed Nixon. Here's Ed talking on C-SPAN in 2009.
Richard Nixon didn't resign in disgrace. He resigned in honor of the office that he held above any man.
Edward Nixon lived in Linwood. He was 17 years younger than his brother, and he looked up to Richard as a mentor and a father figure. Ed wrote a book about his family with the help of Karen Olson. She grew up in Seattle and has her own connections to the Nixons.
I have had 60 years of Nixon involvement in my life in some way. He really impacted my life.
Karen's Richard Nixon story began when she was just an 11-year-old girl writing letters to the then Vice President of the United States. She had seen a speech Nixon gave in 1959 about the evils of communism, and she says it was like Nixon was talking directly to her through the TV.
The next morning, I went to the library and checked out a biography on Richard Nixon, and the more I read, the more I just felt really connected with him, and I had wanted to meet him.
Karen wrote multiple letters to Nixon, and he wrote back. Then in 1962, Richard and Pat Nixon came to Seattle for the World's Fair. This man that Karen admired so much was coming to her part of the world at last. But the timing couldn't have been worse. Karen was scheduled to have surgery on her feet and wouldn't be able to go see Nixon. So she wrote her regrets in a letter and sent it to him. Then on the day he came to town, Karen's mother opened the newspaper and was surprised to see one item in particular. Richard Nixon would be coming to her house to visit her bedridden daughter.
And my mother woke me up, banging on the door, and then she came in, "What's this about Nixon coming out to our house?" And he arrived in a World's Fair limo, and he was kind of like a kindly uncle. He talked to everybody there, especially the children. And he asked us all what we wanted to be when we grew up. I said, I don't know, but I like Spanish. And he said a few words to me in Spanish. And then he told me that I should be a writer. And I remember thinking, I'd like to write a book about you.
Well, Karen did end up becoming fluent in Spanish, and she did write that book. The chance to do that came in 1998. Karen was at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California for an event, and this is where she met Richard's younger brother, Ed, who at the time was trying to put the Nixon family's story into words.
Ed Nixon came wandering by, and the man asked him how he was coming on his book. Ed said, I haven't made any progress. I don't have anybody to help me. And without a thought, I jumped up and I said, I'll help you.
Together, Karen and Ed wrote The Nixons, A Family Portrait. The book includes personal stories that show Richard Nixon in a completely different light than the conniving politician. Like this one. When Ed was 9 years old, Richard took him on a trip to buy a new car.
Richard told Ed, if you learn to read maps, I will let you sit here in the driver's seat between my legs and you can drive this new car.
The one topic in the book that was mentioned only briefly was Watergate.
For me, it was very painful. I wanted to become a hermit. Ever since grade school, I was known as the Nixon girl. And it was very difficult when Watergate came out. But what I came down to thinking is, this man gave me a wonderful gift. He gave me a story and a platform, and I loved him unconditionally. And he also gave a lot to the country. Oh, dear.
Take your time.
Excuse me?
Sure.
And I think Ed was, you know, like that too.
For somebody listening who, you know, they hear this conversation and think, what about the anti-Semitism? What about the Southern strategy? What about this or the other thing? What would your message be to somebody who has a hard time hearing this side of a guy like Richard Nixon?
They should hear it. And even though he would say a few, you know, some things on the tapes, he was not anti-Semitic.
But for people who have a hard time imagining him as anything except a villain, I mean, mm-hmm. What, if anything, would you say to a person who feels that way?
Well, he was not a villain.
That was Karen Olson, a writer and defender of Richard Nixon's legacy. Her great friend Ed Nixon died on February 27, 2019 in Bothell. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Dick Stein and Hannah Brooks Olson. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. Take Sound Effect with you when you subscribe to our podcast. You can do that on Apple iTunes, NPR One, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Please rate and review us while you're there. Even a sentence makes a big difference. And you can also send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. Come on back next week when our theme is augmented reality. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.